I guess some of this I'll touch on as I go through. It'll be a brief overview of IPsec, what is it, why do we want it, and all that kind of stuff. And then some of the kernel issues and problems that I had as I was going along through this stuff. Jess's talk yesterday morning did a very good job of introducing a lot of the kernel issues, and he went through a whole pile of information really fast. But it was I thought it was very well put together. There's a lot of good information there. All right. As far as agenda, I'll go over levels of security, different levels in the stack, authentication versus encryption, and denial of service. What do these mean? What are they? Different types of network shapes. This would be topologies and different ways of protecting different pieces of the network. In IPsec, we've got something called tunnel versus transport mode, which has to do with extra IP headers that are added, similar to what mobile IP uses. Go through the different system layers. What parts are there to FreeSWAN and in general to IPsec systems, setup and configuration issues of FreeSWAN, challenges and solutions, which is the biggest section where I'll go over some of the trials and tribulations to getting here, and some conclusions and then other sources of information. Before I go on, I'd like to introduce three other members of FreeSWAN who are in the room at the moment. The FreeSWAN team has six people in it. Two of them are in the United States. One's an executive manager. One is a testing and administrative manager. And they're not allowed to do any technical stuff other than testing the stuff and bitching to us that it doesn't work. Because they're in the United States and any of this information, that any technical information that they provide to us would make this project no longer exportable from the United States. Because the software falls under, it did fall under ITAR, and more recently there have been injunctions of state of emergency, although you wouldn't necessarily know it, under the Bureau of Export Administration. And so this software is classified as munitions in the States. This is the 128-bit issue, 56-bit stuff, and anyway. I don't want to go too much into the politics, but just to make it clear that this is why this stuff is being done outside the U.S. So for our technical lead, there's Henry Spencer from Toronto. Hugh Redlmeyer, who's worked on the user space keying daemon. And Sandy Harris, who's done the documentation. Okay, in terms of levels of security, going out over the internet using Hotmail or whatever is pretty much like using a postcard. Anybody who's snooping on the net can see exactly what you're writing, who you're writing to, and all of that kind of stuff. To get a little bit more privacy, you could use PGP. They'll still know who the letters are coming from and going to, but you can hide the contents of the letter. The sealed letter isn't really a very good analogy because somebody could open the letter, and although you would know that it's been looked at, they couldn't do it without... In fact, it's a really wrong analogy because it's the only thing I could come up with that would fill that space. The sealed letter will tell you if somebody's looked at the message, whereas an encrypted message, somebody is not likely to be able to look at it, but if they were able to, you wouldn't know. So that's why this doesn't really work that well. I'm still looking for a new idea. SSH and SSL are fairly well known to people here, I'm sure. That'd be like running a daily corporate FedEx down to your branch office somewhere else. It gives a little bit more security, but it's still not 100%. And IPsec might look at it as comparing it to a Brinks truck, but still it could be compromised, as could IPsec through what's called rubber hose cryptography, means that they find other means to get your keys rather than just cryptanalysis. I'll let you guess what those would be. Okay. Authentication versus encryption. Oops. In electronic communication, if you've got no authentication and no encryption, then it's like having sex with a stranger in a public place. You don't really know who you're having sex with, and everybody can see exactly what you're doing. I'll have to thank Alan de Kock for this analogy, who is...
No, don't shrug your shoulders.
Oh, there he is. How can I miss him, the big blonde guy? Okay, so if you do have authentication, it'd be like having sex with your spouse in a public place. You're fairly certain you know who you're having sex with, but still everybody can see what's going on. Okay, again, let's switch it around. Now you, having encryption, it's like having sex at home, with all the blinds turned down, the power cut off, your phone cut off, and soundproofed all your walls so that nobody can see what's going on in there, but you're doing this with a complete stranger that you've dragged home off the street. And of course, the last scenario would be both authentication and encryption, where it's with somebody that you know very well, hopefully, and you're doing it in a very secure place so that nobody else can see what's going on. Now, in terms of denial of service, this is an issue too, but if you're being actively distracted, then you won't be very productive. Okay. Classical VPN tunnel, you would have two networks joined by a third network, which is typically the internet, and those two networks would be private. So what you do is you set up a tunnel between those two networks and run an encrypted tunnel between them. Now, a VPN doesn't have to be encrypted, but most people would like their VPNs to be encrypted. For example, office traffic, if you've got two branch offices that are scattered across the internet and you've got sensitive information crossing them, it would be nice to have both offices appear as if they're side by side, but you don't want the rest of the world to be able to figure out what you're talking about. RoadWire tunnel would be, for example, a laptop through a dial-up ISP service, and you would then connect to a company firewall and set up a tunnel to the firewall, which then lets you in to talk to servers behind the firewall securely. Host to host, that's fairly straightforward. You've got two machines on the internet that want to talk to each other. You just set up a tunnel, or either transport or tunnel mode connection between the two. Difference between transport and tunnel mode I'll cover later, but host to host is the only type of connection that you can have in a transport mode. All the rest must be tunnel mode. An extruded subnet is something that we've coined. If you've got, for example, a provider who can give you bandwidth but only one IP address, and you would really like to have more real IP addresses in there, but they're unwilling to route them, then you could extrude IP from another point in the internet and stuff it into that point. And if you don't want your provider to know that you're doing this, then you encrypt it. And then the last one is really a combination of a number of the other ones, masqueraded subnet tunnel. You can have a subnet that's masqueraded so that you can have a single point of entry for your network. All the rest of the machines that are relatively well protected because they're masqueraded, so somebody has to hack the firewall to be able to get at the rest of the machines, or know something about your network architecture and some of the tricks that you might have used to subvert it. And then what you can do is run a subnet tunnel from there to another machine or another subnet that knows about your non-routable addresses so that you can build your own internet really on top of the internet. Now what happens is if you've got three sites, all of a sudden you're going to start to have clashes between them because you're going to have to coordinate all of your non-routable IP addresses. We've already run into this problem fairly quickly. Okay, tunnel mode versus transport. Transport mode is the way the most packets cross the internet. You've got, let me point. You've got, for example, your data, your upper layer protocol, and then you would have TCP or UDP, and then outside that you would have IP, which would be, well, the TCP would contain your port numbers, IP would contain your source and destination address, and then your Ethernet header would carry the single hop source and destination. What we do with this is we add an extra ESP header in the middle. ESP is encapsulation security payload, which is an encryption header. What this does is it effectively hides all of the data inside. So from the outside, you can see the Ethernet header, IP header, and the ESP header, but nothing inside. So if you've got firewalls, for example, that are doing filtering on specific TCP ports or UDP ports, well, they can't. And this is intentional. This is considered a feature and not a bug. Okay, for tunnel mode, this is the way, as I said before, that mobile IP works and the way that most VPNs are constructed. You could use the IPIP driver or the new tunnel driver, which do both halves. One does encapsulation, the other one does decapsulation. To do this directly, and in fact, that's one of the headers that we use. So you start off with your original packet with your data, your TCP header, and then your IP header and Ethernet. And what it'll do is it'll take, it'll add an extra IP header outside so that you're tunneling between the two firewalls. So for example, say we've got a classical VPN where you've got two subnets, and you're trying to go from one machine behind one firewall or gateway to another machine behind the other gateway, your original IP packet would have the source and destination of those two endpoints. You would add an IPIP tunnel, which has the endpoints of the two security gateways. So now it's being tunneled, and it doesn't matter what those end IP addresses are. They could be routable or non-routable. It doesn't matter anymore because they're tunneled. So once it's tunneled, then we add an ESP header just after the outer IP header, and then the rest of this stuff inside now becomes invisible. So you're able to tunnel stuff so that nobody knows outside your network what's the configuration or topology of your network inside. Okay. The layer that I've been working at is the bottom one. The layer that Hugh Redlmeyer's been working on is the middle layer, which is the Internet Key Exchange daemon. And the top layer is what we're trying to get installed, added to it, to be able to facilitate authentication and key exchange. Authentication and find keys for the parties involved. That's DNSSEC, which has now been published as an RFC, and there is a reference implementation by the Internet Software Consortium. It is exportable, although there's been some contentions with that. because it's authentication only and not encryption. They originally got an export license from the BXA, and after some politics, somebody said, but you let them export that stuff, and so their license got yanked. And after some more politics and fighting, it's now being allowed to be exported again. So DNSSEC and authentication is legal to export. So we're trying to couple that in with Pluto is the name of our Ike daemon, and CLIPS is the name of the IPsec module or portions that get added into the kernel. So we would go and get, for example, a public key from a DNSSEC server for both ends of the transaction. Well, if you're starting from one of the security gateways, then you're going to go and get a public key for the other security gateway. So then you can use that for setting up a Pluto connection between the two machines, which will then go ahead and negotiate keys, session keys, for IPsec. And then it would use some kind of user kernel interface to pass those keys from Pluto or Ike down to IPsec or CLIPS. And we've got our own interface right now based on Netlink, the Netlink driver in Linux, and we're trying to move that over to PFKey version 2. So process is underway. And once the keys get down to the IPsec layer, which is in the kernel, in this implementation, it usually is, but not always, then those symmetric session keys are used for encrypting traffic between specific machines or specific ports on specific machines. Depends on how you've got them set up. Right now, we can only do a resolution of per machine, but the IPsec specification does allow you to use port numbers and user IDs. Okay, for setting up and configuration, you want to grab the... I'm getting a strange look. You want to grab the distribution from Access for All or from Flora, thanks to Russell, who's sitting right beside Alan. Unpack it. It's a tar gzip. Read the documentation. At least read some of it. We recognize that people aren't going to read the whole thing, and it's your brain will probably get full at first reading the whole thing anyway. Get a kernel. At the moment, we're saying 2.0.37, which it does work, but you have to do some manual patching because we're not quite there. But it is known to work on 2.0.37. Right now, we've also got a patch thanks to Marc Boucher of Zero Knowledge in Montreal. Thanks very much. It mostly works, but we've had some strange problems with crashes. So I'm in the process of trying to track that down and debug it. And after emailing Alan Cox, I didn't hear anything for a while and then started getting email from Alexei in Russia. So I gather this is a serious problem. We're going to go back to 2.2.5 and see what happens there, but hopefully this will be solved soon. Oh, yeah, there's no problem with 2.0.36 and 2.0.37. I mean, I've done a lot of testing in 2.0.36, and it's fairly solid. Compile it. Make it work. This is actually important. Because if you don't make it work at this stage, then we've had a number of people who go and install our stuff and blame us for stuff that they hadn't properly tested beforehand. And especially verify the functionality of your network where you can, which means masquerading and all of that kind of stuff. Make sure that you can see your endpoints. If it's all routable IP addresses, make sure you can ping from end to end. Some people may not want to do that because of security concerns, so they don't want to allow their routable IP addresses that kind of access to the net. But in any case, do some verifications that things are at least working from hosts to gateways, both gateways. Compile and install all the utilities and the patches. This is all covered in the documentation. It's been boiled down to a few very simple commands now. Configure and install the kernel. Configure and install the kernel should have been up here first. But it also needs to be down here because after compiling and installing the utilities and patches, you need to recompile the kernel. So I'm missing a couple steps. I'm sorry. And then do the setup. Once you've rebooted, I'm forgetting steps here. Once you've rebooted the kernel after installing it, then you can set up the runtime configuration and set up your addresses of your hosts and networks and then decide how you're going to key it. You could do manual keying on your connections, which we certainly recommend that you try if you're having any troubles with automatic keying. Because there are some little gotchas that can bite you. Like, for example, you've got this firewall that's armed to the teeth, and you don't let through UDP port 500, which happens to be the IKE port. If you don't let that through, then no negotiation's going to happen. So running manual mode can reveal some of these problems. Okay. Some of the problems that I ran into... and ways that I got around them. Where do you jack into the net code? How do we get in there? How do we steal the packets and process them before they end up going out over the wire? When we first got the code, we were getting ping times of 20 seconds to a machine that was on the same piece of Ethernet. Okay, how do we get packets out of here? Routing issues. What if my network is not Ethernet? If you're running PPP or SLIP or any number of other different things, they should work, but they don't necessarily, and we're trying to fix that. How do I recover from oopses? Well, those are fun. Debugging kernel modules. A lot of that was covered by Jess, but there's a few things that I've learned. The proc file system only hands you less than a 4K of page. If you overrun that, really bad things happen. Don't use GFP kernel from the interrupt code, which is another nugget that I tripped on. How do I tell the kernel configs where I put all of the defaults for the software package? And what's the easiest way to manage all the transforms we dumped into here? In fact, the transforms that we inherited. Okay, in terms of jacking into the network code, we originally looked at putting this into the firewall code, and we were strongly advised against it because we were told it was impossible. Looking back, we believe that that was not true and that we should have done it at that point, but it's way too late to do that now, and we'll fix that in 2.2. Virtual devices is what we ended up doing. What we do is we create a virtual device that stores all the pointers to the functions, and they're wrapper functions that take, for example, the hard header rebuilding functions, and we'll call the function of the physical interface that lies underneath this one. So we've got attachment routines that will attach one of our virtual interfaces to a physical interface, and that way it knows how to do all of the hard header stuff and the ARP stuff and filling in the Ethernet source and address addresses. And then what we're looking ahead to is IP chains and IP filter, which is the good place to put this. And in fact, that's kind of an abstraction of the firewall code from 2.0. And this is a good thing that this has happened, and we're looking forward to getting there, but we've been trying to fight other stuff, so we're not quite there yet. We should also be able to use IP chains to do our policy decisions. Right now, we're doing them through something called e-routing, which is a term that was kludged together from some of the history. And that decides what's the policy on outgoing packets and what keys to use, what security associations and transforms. Now, dealing with stalled transmitter, when we got the code, it was using dev point to hard start transmit function of the physical device that we had attached to. And that's fine if you've got a whole ton of traffic going over your network, because one of the other packets will just kick the transmitter and it'll transmit the packets. But if you've got no other traffic going across there, if you call that function, the transmitter doesn't know it's supposed to restart. And the right way to do that is to go through dev start transmit. And it does all that. It checks to see if the transmitter's not busy. It kicks the transmitter and restarts it. The 2.2 world has a lot more variety of output functions, and we're in the process of sorting out which ones are the most appropriate for calling from our code, because we do have fragmentation issues which we have to deal with, because the packets do get larger as we add headers onto them. Okay, initially we could only send transport mode packets to local networks, and this was because we didn't understand the routing that well, and because we're doing these virtual devices, we basically have to duplicate all of the routing information that's on the physical device that we were attaching to. So we did some stupid routing tricks, and we were able to extend 1.0 release of FreeSWAN much further than we initially expected, and so that's why we didn't get there nearly as quickly. It might have been a good idea in retrospect, but it seemed expedient at the time. Okay, if it's not Ethernet, see, what we're doing is we're grabbing the packets after they've had their Ethernet headers added to them. This is probably not the best place to do them, but at the time it seemed like a good idea. We'll go back up and we will start processing the packets before the Ethernet headers or any physical layer headers are added onto the packet, so that we don't have to muck around with those. But part of the problem was that the hard header length of Ethernet's 14 bytes, or octets, we should really say, for network code. And other devices such as PPP are a 4-byte header, and so it's now dynamic rather than having been a fixed length. There are some known problems with some, we suspect that they're buggy PPP implementations, but it's possible that we're not updating part of the hard header after we've stripped it off and put it back. And this stuff would be solved by moving the attachment point of our code higher up the stack, so that we're doing it before it goes anywhere near the hard headers. Okay, non-fatal loops has caused us some problems accessing the module, so that after you got an oops in a piece of code in your module, you could no longer access it to be able to tell it more commands or to clean up or something. So adding a small patch to Netlink allowed us to unload the module, reload it, and that cleared that error state. Debugging kernel modules is a whole lot of fun. Printk is your friend. Use it appropriate syslog priority levels. And this was something that Jess covered, the whole range of syslog priority levels from panic, stop the machine, to this is debug information, ignore it. Syslog defaults to printing info messages, so any debug messages will be ignored by syslog the way it's set up most of the time. And you can set up a separate file so that it will peel off all of the debug messages separately. Compile time debug switches obviously can remove a lot of the code from inside the kernel just to make it faster. But there's some quote that I don't remember exactly how it goes, but it's it goes something like, taking the debug code out of a piece of software for production releases is like removing your parachute from your plane once you think that you are able to take off. We've added some custom interface. Well, using our Netlink custom interface for passing our keys down, we've added some extensions to it so that you can pass in debug switches and on the fly be able to turn on and turn off debugging portions of the kernel, specifically our module. Syscontrol variables can also be used. I don't know how to use them from modules. I don't know if it's possible. But they're certainly possible in a static kernel, and they're another way of doing this other than adding your own infrastructure such as Netlink, because the syscontrol stuff is already there. Am I going too fast, or does anybody have any questions? Am I going too slow? Okay. The PROC file system only hands you slightly less than a 4K page, and really bad things happen if you do write more than 4K to that buffer. It'll bring the machine down in worst case. Well, in fact, it'll scribble all over your disk and do really nasty stuff. At best, it'll do a non-fatal oops and give you some clues that there's something wrong. What you need to do is, as you're writing to the buffer, keep track of how much you've got and return when it's full, giving it a length. It'll give you an offset, and then when it comes back in, then you go through the same procedure again, and when you get to the offset point where it got full the first time, then it starts filling its buffer, and...
Well, is it possible to get two concurrent PROC requests at the same time?
Probably.
So that would require some more handling. This is something I've never found any documentation about module writing.
Right. Are you talking about two requests of the same module, or two requests to the PROC subsystem?
You have a module, and
yeah.
You write a routine to return some text if
right.
Somebody queries the PROC file
right.
System. Is it possible to get two of those requests concurrently? Because here you're returning a little bit at a
yeah.
time, right? So is it possible to get one from one user and get another from another user, and then get one, like a second one, in the continuation of the first user's request? Or is that being buffered higher above?
I don't see why not. It's
traditional. Yeah. Yeah, this is all done inside the kernel,
yeah.
So it's not going back up to user space, but there is a possibility it could get interrupted.
Like, let's say I was running two cat programs from a
proc, right.
CPU info,
yeah.
And the buffer that was getting sent to the CPU info request was, let's say, 2 bytes. So these two are running concurrently. Does the entire CPU info get buffered in somewhere in the user land? Before it gets returned into cat?
No, it gets buffered in the kernel.
No. User asks for 2 bytes, they get 2 bytes. And if you've generated more than that, it will come back and ask you to please provide me the next 2 bytes offset.
So you get that information somewhere in the call, in the handler for proc.
That's right. If you look at the call, they almost always format everything over again.
Okay.
And then just start reading at that point.
Yeah. So you can ask for a specific number of bytes, and that's all it'll give you back.
If you want accurate results, you should ask or read as much bytes as there are, because otherwise it could change a little thing.
Okay. Any other questions? No. About GFP Atomic. This is something Jess brought up briefly, but I learned the hard way that using GFP kernel should only be called from code that's initiated from user space. So as long as there's a PID attached to that process in the kernel, then you can use GFP kernel. But if it's coming from an interrupt, such as a packet coming in or on its way out, then that needs to be a GFP atomic kmalloc. I'm not sure exactly why, but it complained only four times and then didn't complain again. But that's the way it's designed, to only complain four times.
And if you ask your GFP kernel, there's no space available, the system has the right to go ask various things,
right,
to drain themselves and free up memory.
Right.
I
suspect that the GFP kernel is blocking and GFP atomic is non-blocking, but it just refuses. It just comes through and says, have you got the memory? No. Okay, I can't do anything. Quit. And it just faults. Whereas GFP kernels just sit there and wait until it does have the memory. So you don't want that happening in an interrupt. Okay. The configuration defaults for a kernel are stored in Arch / whatever the architecture is, i386 or Spark or whatever you're playing with, defconfig. What happens when you configure a new kernel is it takes the defaults from there and copies them into memory, and then when you save the configuration changes, it saves it to .config. These are both referenced to user source Linux. If you've already configured your kernel, then it doesn't look at the previous one again, and so you still want to get your defaults into the kernel configuration, and so we just append it to the .config, so that at least you got some sane defaults to start with, rather than everything being shut off. Okay. When we first got the code, it had 14 transforms for doing various different combinations of encryption and authentication, and it had a whole routine on how to process this packet from start to finish. So what happened was anytime I added a feature or fixed a bug, I'd have to fix that in 14 different copies of it. So what's been done since then is to change it so that you've got one piece of code that goes through, and if you've got, it selects which encryption you do and then goes on, and which authentication you want to do and then goes on, so that you're fixing only one stream in any case. And if there's bugs in a specific encryption algorithm, it's not likely to affect the other encryption algorithms. This served to, I think, reduce the code by something like 40%. It was... and the both the compiled and source. Okay. I haven't gone into as much detail here. In terms of finding your way around the Linux kernel, most of you are probably familiar with this, but etags and ctags are very useful tools. So is cflow. Etags is a program for Emacs, and ctags is for VI. The two tags programs, what they'll do is go through a piece of source code and find every single function that's in there. And with switches, you can also get it to look for variables. And you can go through your code and then press a magic key combination, and it'll jump to that function name that's underneath the cursor, loading the necessary files if it needs to. I know that VIM and XEmacs are able to undo their tag stack as well, which is very useful because you can go in through a function, wind through it, back up a few, and then go down and start winding through another function. This has been very, very useful for finding out where everything is. Cflow is a tool that I bumped into years ago, and I tried to use it recently, and I got all kinds of headaches trying to use it under Linux. It came up with a huge number of errors, and it came out with only a small fraction of the functions that were actually in the code that I was looking at. So getting around that, I was able to use in fact, cflow is a shell script that calls two other programs, one that goes and looks for the functions, the other one that sorts the functions and figures out which calls which and builds a tree. So using those two functions manually with pipes in your shell I found it very useful. It won't deal with macros this way, and that was partly why CFlow was there, is to deal with some of the macros and do some of the pre-processing. Right, when we got it, the module didn't unload. So it was effectively like having a statically linked module in your kernel. And anytime you want to change something, well, you got to reboot. Initially, when we got it, it couldn't delete any security associations or eroutes. So again, if you added a bunch of eroutes and security associations and you wanted to get rid of them, well, time to reboot. So that was a pretty high priority initially. Memleak Deluxe is a package for detecting kernel memory leaks. I found this to be very useful because I knew that I had some memory leaks, and after checking for a while and doing sanity checks on the code, went and installed this stuff, and within about not even five minutes of running it, looking at output, I was able to nail down exactly where I was losing memory and why. Okay, route stealing. We ran into some problems where once we'd done some internal processing, we go to output a packet and it would stuff it back into IPsec because it thought that it didn't have or it needed to process it again. And so what's being done is inside Clips, there's now a loop that goes through and checks to see if all the processing that needs to be done has been done, and when it's ready, it then stuffs it out, ignoring all of the routing code again. To avoid any of these routing traps. Again, what I mentioned before is the firewall bypassing Ike. This can bite you if you're being a little bit too paranoid. For Alpha, we had somebody in the UK who was beating on our stuff trying to get it to compile on an Alpha. And some of what Jess talked about the other day in terms of portability is quite important. Using long instead of an int is fairly important if you want it to be aligned or if it has anything to do with the native bus size of the machine in question. Pointers in particular were a bit of a headache. And again, using %p in printk instead of uint %d solves this. We used to require IPIP tunnel code to be loaded as well, and because it was such a small portion of code compared to ours, we just included it in our module. Because compared to all of the encryption code and whatnot, it's pretty tiny. I must add also that it was built largely on top of the IPIP tunnel code. Okay, oversized packets with don't fragment set. We had a number of issues that were raised by a client, a tester, somebody at AT&T who was beating on this stuff. And he did a lot of exhaustive testing and found a lot of useful information in order to modify and tune our MTU issues. For example, you send a packet. It starts off by saying, OK, my MTU is 1,500. The MTU on an interface is the maximum transmission unit, which is the number of octets that can fit into one IP frame. Once we encrypt it, we are adding headers of anywhere from 20 bytes up to, if you do a double tunnel with encryption and authentication in the whole nine yards, it can be as much as 250 bytes. So we needed a way to be able to shrink that, but we didn't really want to waste the bandwidth or limit the throughput by restricting our packet sizes. So we start off with a default of 1500, and the first time it calculates, it says, oh, this packet's too big. It changes the MTU on the fly, and then goes back and sends an ICMP saying, this packet's too big, my MTU is now this big. And then do it again if it's wrapped a second time in another tunnel. This isn't perfect, but it seems to be working fairly well under 2.0. There's still issues under 2.2 that need to be sorted out. If it's oversized, We have been sending the packets on, fragmenting them, because there are known problems of hosts along the internet that swallow ICMP MTU messages. PFKey v2 sockets. When I started this, I think used sockets once or twice from user space. I didn't really understand what I was dealing with. And the challenge was to learn, how do I program a socket interface from the bottom up rather than talking to it from the top down? That was quite interesting. Okay. We had discussed extending PFKey v2, which is a keying interface, a user kernel keying interface. It's meant to be generic, so it can be used for more things than just IPsec. It can also be used to get keys between different applications in user space. What we looked at was extending that so that we could add some of our other policy issues to PFKey. We decided against that and try and sort it out through IP chains. OpenBSD have gone ahead and they've modified the PFKey v2, well, not modified it, they've extended the PFKey 2 spec so that they can send all of that policy stuff through that interface as well. It's not portable, and that's one of the reasons that we're shying away from it. And as I've mentioned before, we are having some fragmentation issues in the 2.2 kernels. We're not sure if it's because of us or because of the 2.2. There is some instability in some of the more recent kernels. Okay. If what you're looking for is privacy, obviously you need some encryption to secure that channel. If you're trying to prevent from packets being modified or replaced, or somebody else creating packets to spoof you, then you can deal with that problem with authentication. If you're looking for trust, you would go to a higher level yet and look at DNSSEC, which can go and fetch keys from authenticated servers. There is a problem with DNSSEC of root servers. Who do you trust? And where does the top of that tree start? Initially, right now, we're looking at individual servers that can deal with a subdomain, but the architecture or the infrastructure isn't there yet to do it at multiple levels, and that's expected to come.
Is that keys or certificates?
It would be public keys or certificates. I mean, they're really one and the same thing. It's a question of how you name them or how you format them in the records. It would all be public key stuff in any case. Some of the conclusions from using Linux for this. Proprietary operating systems might be better documented, might be, but not always correctly. I've spent sometimes 2, 3, 4 weeks trying to beat on an interface, a published interface for a proprietary kernel, and discovering that it just didn't work and you need to find a way around it. And the people at the operating system company aren't always helpful and forthcoming or even know that there's a problem. The Linux kernel, I would say it's not that well documented yet, but it's certainly coming along much better. Jess's presentation was very good. That's a good source of resource material. There are a number of books that have been written. But again, coming right back into it, the real reference is the open source that you can look at, which you can't under a proprietary operating system. So you can verify interfaces, you can verify functionality, you can check to see, you know, exactly what it's doing and how and when and that kind of stuff. Which you can't in a proprietary kernel. And obviously, if it's broken, you can fix it, rather than waiting for the next major release. In terms of other sources of information, the motivation for the project can be found at that page. It suggests why we want to go here and what the goals of the project are, the long-term societal goals in terms of giving to society. If you're looking for source code, our primary server is in the Netherlands, and there's a backup, a mirror at flora.org here in Ottawa. Thanks very much to Russell. Okay. IPsec, the RFC, there were an initial set of RFCs which were 1825 through 1829 that were published about 5 years ago. I'm not exactly sure when they came out. Michael?
5 years.
Okay. So there's been a lot of work done on them since, and interoperability workshops getting proven implementations. And so the full set of RFCs came out in, I believe it was December of 98. Start with RFC 2401, and they will link to all of the other interesting and important RFCs. There's also internet drafts, which can be found at ietf.org, starting with draft IETF IPsec. In terms of mailing lists, the primary mailing list for the IPsec standard or proposed standard is listed there. It's at hosted by TIS, and the mailing list for to support our project is hosted at in Finland. That address should be familiar, or that host should be familiar. DNSSEC, again, it's got its own working group and RFCs, which have been published more recently, and also internet drafts that are in process. There's a mailing list for DNSSEC as well. For cryptography, the book that I depend on is Applied Cryptography. This is a fairly well-known standard text. Second edition is what I'm using. In terms of networking, the Linux NAG is quite good. It's a little bit out of date, but it's still relevant. This is included with the Linux documentation project and probably installed with most Red Hat installs. A useful trio of books that I have found about TCP/IP and describing the whole stack. The second volume goes into a lot of detail on, I believe it's a BSD 4.3 stack, and it goes into some fairly good detail. It was very helpful for understanding it. Volume 1 goes through the protocols and their standards and does a more theoretical approach to it. In terms of kernel hacking, the Rubini book, I believe that it finished at 2.1.42. So it's a bit out of date, but it's still very relevant. The Linux Kernel Hacker's Guide. Oh, I forgot to mention here, but those three, I believe, are all part of the Linux documentation project. You'll find the Kernel Hacker's Guide under KHG. The Linux kernel is under TLK. And this is a new one that I hadn't seen before. Linux Kernel Module Programming Guide. What we recommend is that people install this not as a module, but statically linked into the kernel for security issues. It's much more difficult to recompile a new kernel and reboot it without getting noticed than it is to unload a module and reload a module without getting noticed. And loading modules into a firewall is probably not a good idea anyway. You want to probably clamp it down as best as you can. The Linux kernel mailing list, as voluminous as it is also a very useful source of information for anybody doing kernel hacking. And of course, there's the Linux kernel itself, the source code. As they say, use the source. Oh, whoops. How'd that get in there? there any questions?
Can you describe some of those issues about fragmentation of the tissue?
Oh, boy. Okay. Yeah, I'd prefer if people use the microphone because we're trying to record. The question was about clarifying the fragmentation issues in 2.2. We've had mixed reports and experience of it doing a fairly fatal oops and dropping on the floor when we try to fragment any packets. Normal size packets go through no problem because they're going through the normal channels. But anything that calls the IP fragment code with the default of SKB point to dest point to output, which is the output function that was cached by the destination caching system, caused it to just drop on the floor. So we're still working through that. We're not sure if it's an issue in some of the more recent kernels or if we need to go back a few kernels. I've made a change which seems to work for me but has caused more problems for other people. So it's a matter of going back and finding out. And like I said, I've started having this email conversation with Alexei in Russia, and a lot of what he submits as patches, Alan and Dave don't include them unless they work because they don't want to debug them. So anyway, any other questions? Yep.
What encryption and authentication algorithms do you use?
Okay, by default we're using 3DES. The IPsec standard calls for a must on DES and a may on 3DES, and in this regard, we're specifically non-IPsec compliant because we do not implement DES off the shelf. If you're willing to go in and hack the C code, then you could enable it. We don't recommend it because it's been shown to be broken. So that's a political issue, a question of security. And so for authentication, right now we're using 3DES. We are looking at some additional transforms, some that are faster. But we haven't arrived at anything yet, partly because of trying to get these other vertical slice issues fixed in terms of IP forwarding and that, IP fragmenting and important issues like that. In terms of... There were some obsoleted ones that have now been removed. They were... Well, DES was in there, and there was some old modes of DES that conformed to RFC 1828 and 1829. In terms of authentication, we now use MD5 with a 96-bit authenticator and SHA-1 with 96-bit authenticator. We were using 128-bit, but those are obsolete, deprecated. There was also... These are HMAC MD5 and HMAC SHA-1. We also did have an MD5, straight MD5, but that's old and it's no longer deemed useful.
Why triple DES?
Triple DES is thought to be far more secure than DES. You mean why triple DES as opposed to DES, or why triple DES as opposed to anything else? Because it's slow as dirt, but it's sufficient for most uses that we've seen, and it's been beaten on for more than 20 years, and we aren't aware of any weaknesses in it. I realize that there's been a couple of papers by BM that have been published pointing out weaknesses in triple DES. In terms of Blowfish, Twofish, other algorithms like that, we will be implementing the AES winner when it comes out, but that's not here yet. So we want to, we want to concentrate on a vertical slice and get something that we know works. So on modern hardware, it shouldn't be difficult to fill a T1 or even 10 megabit Ethernet with a gateway of, I don't know, a P2350 or 400 or something like that.
Are you going to be compatible with all the quality of service and DiffServe stuff that was presented by Jamal this morning? And if so, have you thought about where all that plugs in?
I'm assuming it would plug in as part of the IP chains, and you could order it in whichever order you want. We would obviously recommend a specific place to chain it in. We haven't looked at it yet. We don't anticipate a problem. Don't know. I'm following the list and reading what's going on. I'm as eager to get this fixed as a lot of other people.
Could you describe a bit more about the PFKey V2 and how you use it?
Okay. How do you mean, how do I use it?
Basically in terms of why you'd use that in particular for exchanging keys between user processes rather than some other mechanism.
Portability is one issue. We'd like to be able to take a number of different keying daemons that are standardized on a keying interface and be able to just drop that in and have that also be able to negotiate. PFKey V2 has the ability to be able to run more than one keying daemon to talk to the kernel. And it will accept input and keys from various different sources and report back what's going on so that all of the other keying daemons can be aware of what each other is doing without actually being aware of each other's keys that they're doing. This is the way the PFKey2 has been designed. Does that answer your question? It was mainly a portability issue so that we could use other people's keying daemons. And that ours would be portable over there as well. Because right now, Netlink isn't portable. It's a Linux thing, and you stop there. So, anybody else? Yep?
Why is it considered a feature that you cannot block traffic on ports anymore?
The whole point of IPsec is to hide the contents of packets. And if you're revealing port numbers, then you're revealing part of the nature of that traffic.
If this is a problem for your firewall, then your firewall simply won't let your traffic through.
Right.
So your firewall administrator has the right to simply say, you can't do IPsec through the firewall because I can't observe what you're doing. And that's the only answer. If you want auditing, then the firewall has to participate.
Yeah.
But how does the firewall know it's an IPsec packet?
Because, I forgot to mention that. The protocol numbers for TCP and UDP are 6 and 17, respectively. That's in the next protocol space in the IP header. So you've got your source address, your destination address. You've got a next protocol number so that it knows how to parse the inside of that packet. You've got a 6 for TCP, you've got a 17 for UDP. Instead of 6 and 17, you've got 50 and 51, depending on whether you're doing authentication and or encryption. So it just looks at that and says protocol 50 or 51. Well, I mean, if it's authentication, obviously it can look inside the packet because that's all it's doing is authentication. But it needs to know how to parse an authentication header and then look inside that. Chances are it's going to be an encryption header inside that. So you won't be able to go any further than the encryption header.
So is that how you switch it on in a firewall? If you do masquerading, for instance, how do you allow IPsec to go through? How do you select it?
In 2.0 kernels, you can't specifically allow or deny that because the selectors in there are limited to TCP, UDP, ICMP, and all. It's a 2-bit selector that's got 4 states. Now, in 2.2 with IP chains, you've got far more flexibility, and you can name specific protocols that you do allow through or don't allow through.
Okay, so you need to use IP chains to do it.
Yeah. Or use, you know, just say admit all and then block TCP, UDP, ICMP.
The IPsec traffic is trying to come through the masquerading gateway. If the gateway itself is doing both the masquerading and the encryption, everything's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole point of IPsec is thou shalt not meddle with these packets. And masquerading is a form of meddling.
Yeah. That's especially true of authentication. It just won't work. There are people who have written some masquerading code for ESP, which I personally think is a really ugly idea, and I don't recommend anybody actually try and use it. But people are getting desperate because of the lack of IP addresses, and so that's understandable that people might be forced to those ends. Hopefully IPv6 will be here sooner rather than later, and we won't have to worry about that stuff.
But in the meantime, what will one do if one is set up with 20 machines behind... Mm-hmm. A 486 with the masquerading and proxy.
Well, and then
one address in the front, and
you set up your masquerading, and your IPsec on the same gateway. Yes. Right.
That's like the case of a lot of people here, I think.
Yeah. Yep.
Only got one little machine, and then you got like, a farm in the back.
Yes. I wouldn't know anything about that, of course.
Doesn't that mean that IPsec cannot be used by people who are going to different locations to plug their laptop in on a different network to try to connect to their own if they're behind someone else's firewall?
Yes, and that's a problem that's going on in hotels right now is they've got maybe one IP address or a few IP addresses, and they're masquerading everybody inside the hotel. If you're trying to tunnel from your hotel back to your firewall, tough.
So, that's why I'm asking.
IPsec inside of TCP or UDP stream?
Yeah.
Some extra overhead, but get over that problem.
Well, the problem is that masquerading looks at the port numbers and it changes the port numbers. And if you're trying to get through a firewall with a protocol that doesn't have port numbers, it's got no port numbers to change.
That's right. But you can wrap it inside something.
You could,
it,
yeah.
It, and then put it through.
Yeah, an IP-IP tunnel wouldn't do the job because it doesn't have any port numbers. But yeah, you could wrap it in, I guess, TCP or something, or UDP and try and get it through that way. But that defeats the whole purpose of IPsec, which is that you're certain who the endpoints are, and masquerading and NAT specifically try and get around that by making it so that it's not important, and it changes the outside of those packets.
If you're desperate, you're desperate, right?
If you're desperate, you're desperate. Any other questions?
What's the statue of IPsec and IP6?
Sorry?
The statue of IPsec and IP6.
The question was, what's the status of IPsec and IPv6? Well, IPv6 requires IPsec, but IP4 does not require it. At this point, we have not gone anywhere close to the IPv6 code, but we're coding with that in mind to make it easier once we get there. There are a couple of implementations that I know of that do IPv6 that are free. One of them is Kami out of Japan, which is for BSD. The other one is the NIST implementation, which is export controlled. So we don't want to know about that one. Anybody else? No? What's our time? What time is it supposed to end?
In 5 minutes.
Okay. All right. Well, if there's no other questions, then we can finish here.